Furman Hewitt today gives our lecture, our faculty lecture, on the subject freedom as a moral concern. He asked me to introduce him. It is a somewhat risky request for him to make, for I have known him for 30 years, and he is no doubt sitting here at this moment hoping I will cast a rather small net in gathering up what I will tell you. You have before you vital facts about him. Among his distinguished accomplishments is the fact that he has earned 5 degrees plus a U.S. Army commission. He has not been one, we might say, to take academic shortcuts. Not only have I been a colleague on the faculty with Furman Hewitt, for 10 years he and I have taught a course together on the family. As any of you know who have team taught a course, team teaching a course is not half as difficult but twice as hard as teaching one by yourself. This course has both tested and strengthened our friendship and reinforced my high esteem of him as a person and as a teacher. In this shared teaching experience, I've learned several things about him, not the least of which is that he knows his stuff as a theologian and as an ethicist. Further, I know that he influences students because he cares about them and establishes trusting relationships with them. Students regularly count on him as a mentor and counselor. More than this, he allows students to know him, and he is honest with them about his vulnerability. He understands that genuine theological education occurs only when the teacher is human and invites the student to be fully human as well. And then I know him to understand that God's incarnation includes the reality that students and colleagues can be the human face of God to him. Perhaps the thing I will remember most about his teaching and his relationship to students is that students regularly bring their pain into the teaching arena with him. That is, students trust him with their suffering, tell him their story, and find in him needed direction for their spirits. Presently, he will deliver a lecture on freedom. I place a high premium on Furman's courageous intellectual and spiritual freedom. I have never known him to bow his knee to any Baal. His subject and his character bring to mind a cartoon from the New Yorker magazine with which I would like to conclude my introductory remarks. The cartoon shows a man approaching his front door with his briefcase in one hand and a cardboard box under the other arm. The box holds the contents of his office desk: telephone slips, pens, pencils, paper clips, an address file, a nameplate, and other odds and ends. He opens the front door and meets his wife, who looks at him quizzically. "I told the truth," he said, "and they set me free."
Professor Hester, colleagues, students, and friends, I appreciate that introduction, Dick. It does, however, remind me of the story I heard about a man who was visiting a South Carolina town which was noted for the abundance of fruit produced nearby. And as he entered the hotel, he saw a great big sign that said, "Peach Festival tonight." But then in small print under it, it said, "Due to drought, prunes will be served." I am, in fact, honored to present a faculty lecture, honored and humbled to stand where so many of my colleagues, past and present, have brought us profound insights and accumulated wisdom from their years of research and teaching. To stand here is to be reminded again of how much I am indebted to them and how much I miss those who are no longer with us. From the vantage point of a sabbatical leave in Hong Kong 1 year ago, I watched the exhilarating moves toward freedom in Eastern Europe that all of us watched, and I suffered with the free citizens of Hong Kong who felt they were keeping a death watch until 1997, when their freedom would be lost to view behind the bamboo curtain. I've watched young people stand on the Berlin Wall, which had blocked so many from freedom, and reduce it to rubble. Freedom. Nelson Mandela was released from prison, and the blacks of South Africa thought they had seen the first rays, the dawn of freedom. But in Kuwait, however, a ruthless dictator's troops quickly obliterated a free nation. And the restrictions on Father Charles Curran is merely a symbol of the fact that in some religious circles, freedom of expression has been repressed under the flag of orthodoxy and in the name of clarifying organizational lines of authority. Sadly, the whole history of the notion of liberty or freedom is rather complex. We do not have time to go into it at great length, but let me just make a few comments. Earlier on, the Stoics talked about universal rights, which were rooted in natural law and reason, and among those were rights of freedom. Others, such as Epictetus, internalized that sense of liberty. They said that a free person is a person who is not subject to compulsion, who is not attached to anything, whether property or even one's body. In the Middle Ages, while the concept of natural rights and freedom remained, the fact is that freedom depended on which estate one was born into. Serfs had very little of freedom. Martin Luther talked about the freedom of the Christian man, but not in socio-political terms. He referred to the freedom of the tyranny of the law as an undependable means of salvation. As the Age of Enlightenment dawned, John Locke argued that human beings have a natural right to life and liberty or freedom and property. And he influenced a Bill of Rights in 1689, which attempted to translate these natural freedoms into positive, legally protected rights. The same emphasis on freedom and rights was picked up 100 years later by the state of Virginia and their Bill of Rights. It was that same emphasis then picked up by the Declaration of Independence in 1776 and by the 1789 Declaration of the Rights of Man in France. The point is that in the 17th and 18th centuries, the concept of freedom as a human right played a central part in the struggles in the Western world against absolutism. Sadly enough, however, these freedoms were not granted to everyone. The course of justice ran unevenly. The 19th century, for example, witnessed periodic struggles for freedom, for example, in the effort to end slavery, but it also witnessed systematic efforts by colonial powers to limit the freedom of the people that they had subjugated. The notion of freedom as a right reemerged during the 1930s and 40s in the outrage felt over the emergence of totalitarian regimes. It was broadly affirmed, I suspect, in the 30s and the 40s that society must acknowledge at least some of the basic rights to which every human being is entitled simply because he or she is human. After the war, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, passed by the United Nations, gave expression to this conviction that people do have rights, among them the right to life and justice and liberty or freedom, including freedom of movement or freedom from unequal treatment before the law, religious freedom and freedom of speech and assembly, and freedom from being tortured or wrongfully detained. As the 20th century ends, the idea of freedom stands as a legitimate right to which all persons are entitled merely by the fact that they are persons. Persons who, as Augustine and Kant and others have reminded us, are not means to some end, but ends in themselves, who must be respected and treated as such. Now, this emphasis on human rights, particularly the broad category of rights under the heading of freedom, should not surprise Baptists. After all, we Baptists have been talking about freedom for almost 400 years. Both in England and in the New World, early Baptists resisted the popular notion that religious uniformity was necessary in order to guarantee the good of society. Faith cannot and should not be legislated or enforced, Baptists have insisted. That great Baptist distinctive, an emphasis on soul liberty or the freedom of the individual to approach God without coercion, is found in the followers of John Smythe, who fled to Holland to be free. It's found in Thomas Helwys, who challenged the claim of James I that he had a divine as well as legal right to dictate the nature of belief and worship. It is found in Roger Williams, who protested the Puritan notion that the purpose of the state was to enforce the standing and moral teaching of the church, as long as it was their church, of course. And the Bill of Rights, that refinement of rights and freedom to help secure the blessings of liberty in the Constitution, whose 200th anniversary we celebrate this year, and particularly the First Amendment in that Bill of Rights, relating to freedom of religion and separation of religion from the power of the state, was heavily influenced by the persistent sacrificial efforts of many in the Baptist community. It's no wonder that E.Y. Mullins focused on soul liberty or freedom as a Baptist distinctive, and no wonder that this theme of freedom is so prominent in his six axioms of religion. I think it's the fourth axiom, what he calls the moral axiom, that particularly concerns me today, because it is the subject of my lecture. To be responsible, he wrote, man must be free. Is freedom a prerequisite for being a responsible, that is, a moral person? The answer may seem obvious to you. Yes, of course. Then we can all go home. Nevertheless, I wish to focus upon that question today for two reasons. As I shall suggest later, we are in danger of separating faith and practice, that is, of affirming a commitment to freedom while at the same time denying it to ourselves or others. Second, we may not understand the concept very well. Freedom, after all, has been used in a variety of ways, and even if the concept is clearly understood, it is still true that the retention of freedom for us and our posterity will depend in part on how vivid its importance is to us. Let us then reflect on what seems to be the obvious, the importance of freedom for moral reflection and action. Now, if we are to properly discuss the importance of freedom, we must attempt to define what we mean by it. We do not want to be in the position of that moral crusader of another generation who said of pornography, "I can't define it, but I know it when I see it." Let us be a bit more precise about what we are defending as being morally valuable. Now, clearly, the term freedom has been applied in a number of different ways. Rational self-determination, the right to be free from outside domination by another state, the right to participate fully with others in determining the course of one's own nation, that is essentially identical with democracy, the right to worship freely, or detachment upon other persons or things as a source of one's own sense of well-being, a modified version of which has been presented recently by Hans Kuhn, the Catholic theologian. Or self-perfection, the idea that one can live in conformity with some ideal, surely that is freedom. Freedom from ignorance, St. Ambrose proposed that. The right to choose, a power of self-determination, or liberty in Christ from control by the powers of this world so that sin and death no longer hold sway over the individual, a position advocated by Jacques Ellul in his book, The Ethics of Freedom. I do not wish to negate the truth inherent in many of these notions, particularly the notion of Christian freedom, of course. But I am in agreement with P.H. Partridge, who said that the most basic conception is that of the ordinary person, and it is the most important. Freedom is the condition characterized by the absence of coercion or constraint imposed by another person. A person is free to the extent that she can choose her own goals and conduct, can choose between alternatives, is neither compelled to act nor prevented from acting by the will of another person, government, or authority. Here we address the most basic of freedoms, from which the social freedoms of voting and national self-determination and worship and so forth finally stem. For none of these freedoms would be intelligible without the basic freedom of personal self-determination and choice without outside influence. Professor R.C. Mortimer of Oxford stated as clearly as anyone why freedom is a fit subject for moral reflection. Freedom is necessary, he said, since there can be no moral life and growth unless there is room and scope for conscious choice. First, let's look at what he said. There can be no moral life without conscious choice. Who would justify passing moral blame on a person when there is no choice to be made? The very idea of a moral obligation would have no meaning apart from freedom. If I truly ought to do a thing, I must be able to choose to do it. To put it another way, if I have no freedom to choose differently, to act differently, then the concept of my being responsible is simply an illusion. Recognition of this fact is basic in Western systems of jurisprudence. Let me add an aside. Let me note the strange fact that many persons do persist in passing moral judgments on others for circumstances or acts which are not subject to a contrary choice. For example, whatever we may say about the choice to use drugs to begin with, they are acts performed while under the influence of drugs for which the individual has not made a conscious choice and therefore may not have been able to do otherwise. An even more pressing and emotional illustration has to do with those persons who have a homosexual orientation, but who no more chose that orientation than the majority of us chose to be heterosexual in orientation. Tragically, however, there are those who continue to label the orientation itself as sin, that is, as a moral wrong for which the individual is responsible. Every moral judgment we make presumes or ought to presume freedom of choice on the part of those making decisions and carrying out acts of any kind. Now, to be sure, there are some who have argued for a denial of any free will on the part of individuals, for a kind of naturalistic determinism, or what William Temple called a stark determinism, in which everything is determined by material antecedents. In its strictly mechanistic form, determinism is logically contradictory and receives little support today, and I will not discuss it. A theological version of determinism has been more popular, but it is equally detrimental to moral reflection and action. According to the theological version, elaborated by Augustine and some of the reformers, fallen humanity is totally incapable of making right moral judgments. Humanity sins inevitably and by fateful necessity, but is nevertheless said to be responsible. Only the grace of an absolutely sovereign God can redeem humanity from its absolute bondage to sin. The freedom to choose to do the right is like salvation, a special gift of God. It is God working in us. Now, the logical impact of this position would be that none of us would be morally responsible for our choices and attitudes and acts prior to this reception of divine grace. We could not do otherwise than what we do. Therefore, no freedom of choice, no moral responsibility. No moral responsibility, no sin. No wonder that Reinhold Niebuhr called this position a moral absurdity. There's a third version of and modified version of determinism, which has been advocated by William Temple as an alternative to stark determinism. Temple agrees that all acts have causes, but freedom, he says, is not the absence of determination, it is spiritual determination. It is determination by what seems good as contrasted with irresistible compulsion. Now, this is a limited determination. For an integral part of the process is the will of the personality, and the will of personality is something in process of formation throughout life under the influence of our environment and natural and social conditions. The locus of the freedom is then in the personality as a whole, because the human personality is a self-determining, self-integrating system. There is an element of freedom. Now, the point of this, of course, is to say that it is plausible to assume, then, that for all persons, Christian and non-Christian, educated and illiterate, Westerners and Asiatics, there is a basic freedom to choose upon which the concept of moral responsibility is based. Now let me come back to a second item in Mortimer's statement about freedom. There can be no growth unless there is room and scope for conscious choice. Without genuine freedom, there could be no effort toward the maturity and the self-fulfillment which Christians and non-Christians alike affirm as a goal of Christian life, of human life. The persons we admire, is it not true, are those who have faced hard choices and struggled with real temptations and questions and have had the strength to make reasoned, even if sometimes imperfect, choices. Augustine said that the true end of humankind is to find and possess the perfect good which is capable of satisfying our desire for happiness. But the only perfect good is God. To be fulfilled or self-realized, is it not, is in part to be what God intends humankind to be. Because we're made in the image of God, endowed with reason and choice, achievement of that end involves the use of that freedom which has been given us. It is our human lot to seek the God who has sought us, to obey God's will as it has been given us, even if this is perceived in a hazy and unclear manner. For it is only by such struggle that we grow into the maturity of full manhood or womanhood for which we were intended. Parenthetically, let me say a third reason why freedom of choice is crucial as a moral concern is that many of the specific freedoms that we talk about more commonly are dependent upon a prior freedom of the individual to claim the right of deliberation and choice for himself. Well, I have suggested that freedom, defined broadly as lack of coercion and liberty to choose, is in fact crucial for moral action and reflection, and must therefore be encouraged and supported. Let me briefly sketch out some further observations about such freedom. First, freedom is given in the created order. Freedom is the potential possession of all persons, not just Christians. The Christian community should certainly affirm this as consistent with our understanding of creation and the respect for freedom characteristic of Jesus' earthly ministry. We affirm a creation in which humankind is free to obey or disobey the will of its creator. The fact that we humans all live east of Eden in our relationships with God and each other is a vivid reminder that we all have chosen wrongly, but we have chosen. Of course, in the second place, by our definition of freedom, there's no such thing as complete freedom. To some degree or another, we are all influenced by heredity, environment, custom, and family. Freedom is of necessity partial, corrupted, and incomplete. It is therefore both a condition given in the order of creation and a goal toward which we strive. Third, freedom, whatever its degree, is never exercised in isolation. To speak of coercion, or the lack thereof, logically points to some community which potentially exercises coercion. It would, in fact, not be logical to use the concept of freedom as absence from constraint or coercion in a world inhabited by only one person. That would be a meaningless concept. The exercise of freedom, therefore, must allow for the freedom of the rest of the community, and the self which exercises freedom must find fulfillment as a member of the community. If, as we believe, the goal of creation is the creation of community, community with God, other humans, and with nature, then the exercise of free choice must finally not be distinguished from the choices and perceived good of the wider community. When that condition is achieved, and we are not there yet by a long shot, choices will no less be free because they are in harmony with the good of the wider community. Fourth, logically, freedom from coercion implies a freedom for that which is chosen. Freedom cannot be seen as purely subjective, as the absence of coercion, but it is concerned with the intersubjective, with what is chosen and how that choice is justified. 5, the coercion which threatens to negate freedom must be understood as including not only the direct forms, such as commands or prohibitions backed by sanctions or superior power, but also the many indirect forms, manipulations, and moldings of the conditions that affect the alternatives available to other people. And finally, if freedom means choice, it logically means that a choice can be made, that there is a choice, that alternatives are known from which choices can be made. The extent of freedom in an individual and in a society is consistent with the extent to which competing opinions and ways of living are on display, on how freely they can be recommended and criticized and examined. At some length now, we have stated the obvious, that freedom in the sense of freedom of choice is a crucial assumption for anyone engaged in the task of moral reflection and action. It's no wonder that books by the score have come from philosophers and theologians defining freedom, using it as an organizing concept, and extolling its virtues in a variety of social settings. Let us be serious. Who would dare to oppose the concept of freedom? Hitler's demand for living space for the German people illustrates that even the greatest tyrants use freedom, for some at least, to justify their domination of others. Point is that mere affirmation of freedom will not suffice. Freedom may be one of the most praised yet least observed of virtues. Therefore, we cannot end our discussion of this most precious of concepts without calling attention to some of the ways freedom is being threatened, usually in the name of some social or religious good. For example, we have the problem of efforts to control the choices of others by the use of power and coercion. Personal freedom takes place at 3 levels: the freedom to think, that is, freedom of opinion, the freedom to communicate that opinion in speech or writing, and finally, the freedom to act on the basis of that opinion. Clearly, communication and action are more easily restricted, but succeeding generations' thinking can be controlled by the manipulation of communication and action which influence them. It is no wonder, then, that each generation must be alert to those who attempt to control free thinking by the limitation of freedom of speech or acts. Our Baptist ancestors fought this battle at the point of legal restrictions on the freedom to communicate or practice their faith. Separation of church and state was ultimately simply a means of protecting the most basic human freedom, the freedom of opinion and choice. Our danger may be at a different point. Instead of being the controlees, we are tempted to be the controllers, using our influence within the state or majority status in institutions to limit other people's freedom. The attempts to use power are well-meaning, of course, for we assume that we have the truth on our side and that we control others for their own good. I do not mean to judge the intention of other people when I say this. Nevertheless, let me suggest that there is an inherent danger in current attempts to control the freedom of other people, such as the attempt to enforce the practice of prayer on captive audiences in public schools, to limit the right of terminally ill patients to choose how and when they die, to control reading material in classrooms and libraries because it does not fit one's preconceived standards of morality, or totally restrict the access of parents to abortions. Now, I recognize the complexity and emotionality of these issues, which we do not have time to examine in detail. I merely wish to point out that a crucial issue in all of these is whether one's freedom to a particular opinion, for example, that abortions are wrong or that prayer is a good thing, is a liberty which should be forcibly denied to other people as well. John Stuart Mill, more than 100 years ago, in his little essay on liberty, argued persuasively that the sole reason for which society is warranted in interfering with any freedom is self-protection, that is, protecting the equal claims to freedom by the rest of society. More positively, he said that the particular evil of silencing the expression of an opinion is that it is robbing the human race. Those who object to the new opinion, even more than those who hold the new opinion. He said that if the current received opinion is false, which is a possibility, of course, since none of us is infallible, suppression of the contrary opinion may be the suppression of truth. To deny ourselves access to contrary opinions is to deny an essential human quality, and that is the capability of rectifying our mistakes and erroneous opinions by experience and or discussion. For the sake of argument, however, said Mill, let us assume that the received opinion is true. Suppression of the erroneous opinion is still wrong. For however true their opinions might be, if it is not fully, frequently, and fearlessly discussed, it will be held as a dead dogma and not as a living truth. End of quote. Assenting to truth without genuine knowledge is not knowing the truth. It is a form of superstition in which one accidentally clings to the words which enunciate truth. Let us be clear. Beliefs superficially held, however true they may be, do not have that liveliness which allows them to penetrate the feelings and acquire a real mastery over conduct. A second area of threat, efforts to control information. Freedom of choice is a reality only insofar as the individual has genuine options from which to choose. A person who does not have sufficient information on which to base decisions has in fact been deprived of freedom by ignorance. In some cases, the ignorance is of a person's own choosing. To willfully avoid the chance to understand is an exercise in free will, I grant you. It is, ironically, also a choice which starts one down the road of lost freedom and therefore of lost humanity. From a moral perspective, it is doubtful that we have a right to believe anything we wish, because we do not have a right to make of ourselves anything less than what we were intended to be, full-orbed persons individually possessing and exercising genuine freedom. Equally fearful is the prospect that ignorance would be deliberately forced upon us by the larger structures of society, thereby robbing us of intelligent choice and therefore a degree of freedom. Here we should view with alarm the effort of government and public figures and institutions and businesses to control the news, to manipulate contents of facts, to exercise spin control in the name of putting the best possible face, as they see it, on the facts. By the way, we're seeing a wonderful example of this in the Middle East right now. It is at least vaguely disturbing to me to see the restrictions on access of news media to combat areas and the one-sidedness of press briefings with their vague but optimistic projections and their carefully selected videos of bombs hitting head-on the targets. A third area of concern, and that is the restrictions on free investigation and debate in educational and religious circles. We Baptists began as a lampoon, persecuted minority whose rallying cry was a demand for the freedom to exercise our competence in relationship to God. Our ancestors would be controlled by neither king nor bishop. Much that has distinguished us over the centuries, separation of church and state and local church autonomy, for example, is intimately related to that thirst for freedom. Sadly enough, we've not lived up to our best insights. Our efforts, born in greed and nourished in cultural accommodation to use racial minorities for our benefit, and our stubborn efforts to deny women equality with men, these testify to our failure to demand for others what we assume for ourselves. And yet our ideals and our traditions of freedom surely can be defended as having value. If so, responsible leadership among us has the obligation not only to recover this heritage, but also to embody this ideal of freedom. Institutional structures themselves should be so biased toward freedom that the issue of creedal controls and institutional witch hunts would never rear its heretical head. Pluralism, the right to question, freedom from coercion, these should be taken for granted if we have come to terms with our heritage, if we know the rock from which we are hewn. We will be committed to responsible shared governance in our educational institutions, not because accrediting agencies favor it, but because we are committed to the idea that the will of God is more likely to be found in the voice of all the people than in the voice of any single self-styled authority. We will open our windows to fresh insights, secure in the knowledge that, as Thomas Jefferson wrote, truth is great and will prevail if left to herself. Truth is a proper and sufficient antagonist to error and has nothing to fear from the conflict unless by human interposition, disarmed of her natural weapon, free argument and debate. I hesitate to mention the last of my threats to freedom. It is the least tangible and the most terrifying. For what I have said today, just as our post-Enlightenment Western society assumes, is that we all yearn for freedom, that we believe that our way of life is better because we're free, and that we want to remain that way. Our freedom motto could well be, give me liberty, give me freedom, or give me death. But suppose that is not the case with some of us. Suppose freedom is fearful, while security is the most desirable. Suppose we take freedom for granted, or suppose freedom is viewed as forcing us to make uncomfortable decisions, or giving others free rein to act or think in ways we find strange. Freedom, in that case, can be easily shunted aside. A classic description of this rejection of freedom is found in Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov, in the chapter entitled The Grand Inquisitor. In this chapter, Ivan tells Alicia a parable which is set in the 16th century in Spain at the height of the Inquisition. According to him, Jesus returns for one day to earth, the day after the Grand Inquisitor presided over a large-scale execution of almost 100 heretics. The crowd recognizes Jesus and has already burst into shouts of praise when the Grand Inquisitor, knowing that it is Jesus, orders his guards to arrest him. That night, the Grand Inquisitor visits Jesus in the prison cell and there justifies himself and his Inquisition. The heart of his argument is that Jesus tried to set mankind free, but mankind does not want and cannot bear freedom. So he, the Grand Inquisitor, took this terrible gift of freedom from them. The freedom that Jesus bestowed was an affliction and a scourge. Humanity suffers from it and cannot sustain it. It makes demands that they cannot meet. Humanity does not possess the dimensions, the stature, and the strength to endure it. Satan, tempting Jesus in the wilderness, he says, had the right insight. What mankind really wants, what it craves, says the Inquisitor, is mystery and authority. To quote, man has no more pressing need than to find someone to whom he can hand over as quickly as possible the gift of freedom with which the poor wretch comes into the world. He has a need to find someone to worship, someone who can relieve him of the burdens of his conscience. End of quote. And Jesus, the advocate of true freedom, just gets in the way. The Grand Inquisitor says that he serves a deeper human need for security, for miracles and mystery and authority. Is his assessment of human nature correct? Consider the evidence. He may be right in some degree. The continued appeal of totalitarian regimes, the popularity of charismatic religious leaders who have simple and infallible answers for virtually everything, the resurgence of ethnic tribalism in the rapidly fragmenting Soviet Empire, a hunger for miracles, either religious or medical or psychoanalytic, which will assure our health and happiness, the giddy speculations of New Age religions, chronic dependence upon drugs, all these and others are indications that freedom produces anxiety and that we search for our security where we can. The sad fact is that the glowing coals of freedom may be dampened to the point of extinction without our awareness. Indeed, we may even wave the flag of freedom while we march resolutely into bondage. Having sought the comfortable world of security, we may sell our birthright and never realize that it is gone. Freedom, the ability to choose, is God's gift to those made in God's image. Imperfectly realized, often suppressed by external forces as well as our own choosing, freedom still remains as a gift and as a goal, an indispensable element in our efforts at realization of our potential to be fully human, indispensable in our efforts at creating a morally accountable society. The shackles of indifference and oppression must be broken and rebroken again until all God's children can sing, "Free at last, thank God Almighty, we're free at last." For freedom is worth fighting for humanity as God intended us to be is the prize. Thank you.
And now may the liberating God of Israel and of Jesus Christ free your spirit from all bondage and idolatry. May you embrace God's freedom as a gift and as a commission to liberate all who are oppressed. May you be empowered and sustained in this mission by the one God who, like a mother, ceaselessly gives her nurture and peace. Amen.